Warning, the Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Is the Savage Nation. Of course, today's big story is Afghanistan. The peace president is going to war. He's going to ramp up 30,000 more troops. And look, I know how many of you feel, and I know that many of you are split on this, but you got to ask yourself one question. Would you send your son to fight and die in Afghanistan? I mean, be honest with yourself. Now, there are those in the radio business who are gung-ho militants and they want war. But they're way past draft age. There is no draft anyway, so it's cheap for them to say, sure, go ahead, gung-ho. It's the neocon crap all over again. I was ambivalent about the Iraq war after about 2003 because it was dragging on and something didn't make sense. Now, with regard to Afghanistan, I keep hearing, well, if we were to withdraw, it would be catastrophic. Al-Qaeda would have a victory. It would cause recruitment around the world and all of that. Well, you know what I say? Is it worth your son dying on such spurious grounds? I do know this, that we don't really know the whole picture, and we don't even really know what we're doing in Afghanistan. We do know this for sure as well. It is now Obama's war. It may have been started by Bush, but we were told during the campaign that when he became president, Obama said he would end the war and he would capture Osama bin Laden. Now, what part of that don't we understand? I guess we're not supposed to remember that. Now I understand on a trivial note here, women are lining up to claim that they've had affairs with Tiger Woods. I don't know whether it's just trying to cash in or whatever. You got the gate crashers saying, oh, their life is ruined. Please, please ruin my life more. My life is ruined. My wife and I's life are ruined. Can we please go on another show? What skanks? You've heard of white trash? These two are the skankiest white trash I've ever seen in my life. Well, anyway, we'll let that one go. As far as Tiger Woods, you heard my joke of yesterday. There's no point in repeating it. In the broad stroke, it's this. I said, I don't know how women help their husbands after a car crash in Sweden, but I know that they don't drag them through broken glass in America. Maybe it's something they do in Sweden. I mean, who ever heard of breaking in a rear window and dragging your husband over broken glass after a minor car accident? Perhaps that's something they do in Gothenburg. Don't know. And by the way, speaking of accidents, did you hear what happened to the pro football player who married a virgin and got caught cheating? She broke his Heisman. That's right. That's what happened. 1-800-4. I don't know what's going on with me. I'm waking up at about 4:15 in the morning with jokes now. I'm making myself laugh. Why is that? Maybe there's hope for me yet. Maybe I won't die with a grimace on my lips. Maybe I'll go back to my normal happy self that I was as a child before all sorts of tragedies befell me and my family. I mean, it's not bad. I'm waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning telling myself, well, I'm not even telling myself jokes. They're running through my head, and they're not bad either, by the way. Between yesterday and today, there's a hope for me yet. Anyway, there's a lot to laugh at. You know, we got the science gangsters, the ClimateGate story, the scientists at the center of the controversy in England is going to step down. I'm going to say step down. What does step down mean? They're throwing the bum out. And a so-called Penn State professor is also going to be investigated. You know, that'll go nowhere. It's a lie. It's a sham. It's a method of control and taxing us to death. All you got to know is this. If Al Gore is behind it, it's a lie. All you got to know is this. If Boxer is behind it, it's a scam. All you got to know is this. If they won't listen to any opposition science, they're not scientists. The definition of science is that you're able to ask questions. All of science is built upon skepticism. So now they're saying skeptics are illegal. You can't ask anything that's skeptical. It means that you're a non-believer. That's right. Science is not about belief, schmuck. Science is about proof, not belief. So if you're one of those who believe in global warming, you're not at all interested in the science. You're interested in the belief. That's all. Tampa Don, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please. What's on your mind?
I am amazed at your insight. I don't know whether to call you a prophet or just over so intelligent. On the news today, 4 people arrested for helping that cop killer, and you said it. You said it the night before, the day that it happened. I'll bet you there's somebody helping him. There are going to be people.
Well, I mean, that's logical. Logical that I don't think that that takes prophetic insight to know that, Don. I mean, there were a group of people who were going to help him. Family and friends would help a cop killer because that's what they believe in. That's sort of their religion, to kill police.
I'm humbled. I've been on hold for your show several times and hung up because you had such an awesome, the author you had on the other night. I was so humbled.
You mean the climate skeptic, the real climate scientist yesterday?
No, it was Josh. It was Roush. And the author that you had such a wonderful conversation, I hung up.
You mean last week when I spoke to the fiction writer?
The fiction writer. I just hung on every word. It was just like, it was like a wine tasting. You know, some bottles are better than others. Your show is like wine tasting. Some nights you pop the cork on something that is just memorable.
That's very beautiful. In other words, some nights it's like Two Buck Chuck. Other nights it's like Dom Perignon.
Well, I wouldn't say it's that big a shot difference, but
I got to tell you the truth. I did a blind tasting last week on Two Buck Chuck. A lot of people thought it was the best wine on the table. Well, no, I forget. That was really good because James Ellroy is a superb fiction writer, and I'm one of the only people in America who I think could draw him out the way I did. And that is because most people in the media wouldn't know where to begin with him. They would have no idea how to talk to the guy.
You've got that envelope opener that can just pull, you know, cut that envelope open that nobody else can get.
Don, may I ask you, you listen to me in Tampa, what do you do for a living?
I am a self-employed painter.
Well, you're certainly an intelligent man, and I say that not because you like me or you like my show. Of course, that's part of it, but it's because what you just asked me and the things you just said are extremely insightful. You're the bedrock of America. You're the men who built America. You're the men who keep America alive. It's the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. It's the painter. It's the contractor. It's the tire changer. It's the truck driver with common sense. Do you know that, Don? It's not the schmucks in the media, and it is not the people in politics. You know that as well, I'm sure.
After I got over the shock of listening to you, it took a couple of months, I realized it was me that was behind, not ahead. And I've been catching up.
Well, Don, I want to say this. Let me send you a free copy of Banned in Britain. It's my way of saying thanks and Merry Christmas to you. I guess it's still legal to say Merry Christmas on the Savage Nation. If it isn't, you know what you can do. You know what you can do if you don't like it, huh? You can tune into Minaret Radio for all I care. Chicago, Mike, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, 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 yes. 1,000 times yes.
You've asked many times over the last week, why are we in Afghanistan?
Yes, I have.
I'm going to tell you why we're there. It's like really clear to me why we are there. And
okay.
We are there because during the campaign, Obama had to sound presidential and not sound like a wuss. Bush was already in Iraq, so he couldn't pick Iraq. So he picked Afghanistan and said, this is the danger. This is where we got to be. And now,
well, you know, all during Bush's years, I kept having liberals call me who would say, we shouldn't be in Iraq. And I would say, where should we be? They would say Afghanistan. That was the liberal party line, is that we're fighting the wrong war in the wrong place. And I would say, what's the right war in the right place? They would all say Afghanistan. Do you know that that was their mantra for over 5-6 years?
You know, I'm not even sure Obama really wanted to be in Afghanistan as much as he needed something to talk about.
No, he'd rather have a private army fighting conservatives rather than fighting the Taliban. I understand that.
I just think he got stuck wearing it, and unfortunately now we're all wearing it.
Well, not all of us are, just people with sons who are of military age who have enlisted. They're the only ones who are going to die for this. It's certainly not going to be the sons of anybody in the U.S. Senate. Can you name one U.S. senator who has a son who's going to go to Afghanistan and fight? I can't name one. Can you name anybody on the Democrat side who has a son or a daughter in the military? I know there are a few. I know Biden's son is there, but he's a lawyer and he's back already. Is there anyone in the military, is there anyone in Congress who has a combat-ready child in the military? I can't think of one.
You probably would know. You're on top of it.
I know. I don't know. I don't know. Name one Democrat, one Republican, who has a combat veteran relative in Afghanistan or in Iraq or ready to go over there. I don't think of one. I've never seen a time in history when so many politicians are so disconnected from fighting and dying for the country, and they're in it just for their own self-interest and pushing the interests of the special interest that got them there, truthfully. So, you know, those of you who don't know why we're there and you're believing the big lie that, you know, if we don't fight them there, they're going to be here. It's the same thing again. I keep hearing it, which is like, if we don't beat them there, it'll be a big victory for Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and blah, their war. You tell me that after all these centuries, we are going to, in essence, control the tribes of these countries. It's impossible. Moreover, it may not even be advisable. So I don't know what this is all about. I haven't any idea what this is about, truthfully. But if you don't want to get that esoteric about it, ask yourself a down-to-earth human question, which I did at Thanksgiving the other night. When someone said to me, what do you think about the war in Afghanistan? I turned to him and said, would you send your son to fight there? They looked at me and said, no, absolutely not. I said, that's your answer. You know, I don't think that the same answer would have come back, you know, in previous conflicts. I have to go back again to the last conflict where there was clear consensus in America once the war had started, and that's World War II. And by the way, there was no consensus in America to go to World War II either until Pearl Harbor. It was only after the attack on Pearl Harbor by the Japanese that Americans generally rallied around FDR. But before that, this country was very much a pacifist nation in the 1930s. There's a whole story about the pacifism. It was socialist early on in the 30s. It actually, in fact, America in the 1930s, prior to World War II, was very akin to what Obama and his left-wing university pinhead minions are doing. I'll be right back. So what's on everyone's lips who has a brain is Afghanistan. I mean, Obama's not the peacenik that he pretended to be. On one hand, you might say, well, that's good. Yeah, well, that's good if it's, you know, not your son going over there. It's good. But the fact of the matter is, why are we in Afghanistan? I still don't understand the rationale. And you have to make it very personal. Would you send your son to fight and possibly die there? Now, you well know that nobody in Congress has to face this problem. I don't know of anyone. Maybe there is one or two, perhaps. And which side would they be on? I don't know. I know the most gung-ho for war are guys in the media who call themselves conservatives, like Rush and Hannity. I mean, frankly, they're beating the war drums. And I find it a little uncomfortable, frankly. I hate to use a PC phrase, but there's an ick factor in that. You can't beat the drums for war if you yourself are not subject to being called up. Otherwise, it's kind of really tawdry to use a word that doesn't even apply, but it approaches it. You know what I mean? So that's the story. Now, women are lining up to claim affairs with Tiger Woods. Oh, God. Two women set to go public with claims. Tiger Woods with his wife, Ellen Nordegren. Nordegren, Swedish girl. At the President's Cup. What's this? Well, let's let that go. Let's let the Swedish thing go for the minute. There's too many jokes from the past. Jamie Grubbs, a cocktail waitress. Oh, sometimes life is so good. Jamie Grubbs, 24, a cocktail waitress, tells this week's edition of Yours that she had a 31-month affair with Woods. And that she has more than 300 text messages, some of them described as racy, to prove it. Oh, man. Doesn't this guy ever watch television, never put it in writing? I mean, even if you just watch the early Mafia movies, you never put it in writing. They talked on a public phone. What are these guys, stupid? This reminds me of the ex-governor of New York. What a schmendrick this one was. All right, the guy, look, it's as old as sin itself. We understand that. So you're not going to make too much of it. At least, thank God, it's with a woman. You know what I mean? You got to count your blessings. Okay, so you start with the top. But the ex-governor of New York was booking hookers through a third-party agency and paying through an offshore account by credit card, and he never thought he'd get caught, and this guy was the top cop, basically, in New York State. Well, okay, and he was, by the way, about to bust Wall Street before Wall Street busted America. That's why they pulled this card on him. They knew his proclivity. They knew the guy's weakness. They held it as a card over him. And the day Spitzer came down and said he's going to come down on Wall Street, all of a sudden they had his records and they said he's with the hooker, blah, blah, blah. And that was the end of Spitzer. Because, you know, what's good for a GS is good for America. GS is short for Goldman Sachs. It's the GS of A. Not the US of A. It's the Goldman Sachs of America, GS of A. Ms. Grubbs. Meanwhile, send nightclub hostess. Blah, 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 blah. No, oh, another one. He crashed his Cadillac Escalade while reportedly fleeing from his furious wife. Rachel Uchitel lamented, what kind of name is Uchitel? Does anyone know? I'm always interested in the ethnic background. First thing I ask is, she looks great in jeans, but what is Uchitel? Does anyone know the ethnicity of the alleged affair with the girl? What's Rachel Uchitel? What kind of name is Uchitel? Take out the Itel, it's Rachel Uch. That's a name that should have been changed at birth. I mean, let's say it's Norwegian or whatever. They have weird, like, translated names into Anglo. Rachel Uch Itel. Can change that one around and have some fun with it. I love it. Oh, no, I had no sex with him. It's horrible. I'm not a homewrecker. And then the gate crashes at the White House. It's ruined our life. What a bunch of garbage. Can you imagine? Let he who is without sin cast the first stone. That's why I'm not casting the first stone. I'm casting the thousandth stone. You see, Beowulf? You get it? A Las Vegas cocktail waitress. What a cliche that is. Hey, look, I don't care. The press has nothing better to report on. They're not talking about the cop killer anymore. It's about this. That's all. Look, if you're married for looks and not love, this is what you get. Him and his wife deserve each other. You know what I mean? That's what it is. He married for looks. Look what he got. What do you expect? To be a pacifist woman when he's the... You know what I mean? That's all. What else is there to talk about? The war, Obama, Oshmama, journalism. What journalism? There is no journalism anymore. There's only talk radio and the blogosphere. Journalism is dead.
Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. We're all awaiting Obama's speech, and we know what it is already. He's going to send 30,000 troops. And on one hand, many of you are happy because, well, you figure it'll make America safer. I'm not so sure to make us safer, number one. And number two, I don't know that it's worth one American kid dying for those animals over there, frankly. I mean, they're tribal people. They live in the Stone Age, half of them. I haven't any idea why we're sending our boys over there to begin with. And number two, with rules of engagement that Houdini himself couldn't follow. The half of them are going to come back crippled or maimed mentally or physically. A good portion of them are going to die for what? For political gain. For what reason? To show that he's not anti-military, to show he's not a wimp, to show that he's not a leftist, to show he's not a communist. I mean, what's it all about? You really think there's a strategic reason for being there? I don't know what it is. I'm bewildered by this because normally I'm opinionated, as you can well understand, and I have a firm position on things. I have a fairly firm position on this, but not as adamantly as you might think. And I've heard all of it. It is now clearly Obama's war. Win, lose, or draw. It's Obama's war. Let's stop saying Bush started it already. Move on. Move on to reality. It's Obama's war. 30,000 more men. It's going to be 100,000 U.S. troops there within 6 months. And he says he's going to pull out in by the year 2013. And if they actually whack the enemy, or if they interrogate the enemy a little too toughly, they get a court-martial. And that is because we have a leadership vacuum in the U.S. military. When you look at the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, if you look at the defense secretary, I don't know that these men have any combat experience. I have to be very honest with you. I would like to see the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff come up through the ranks, someone who actually fought in combat. I would like to see the defense secretary. I realize it's a civilian job. Somebody who understands what it's like to fight and what it's like to die and knows what it is like to capture the enemy after some of your men have had their guts shot out. And so if you slap them around a little bit to prevent further death, you should not be court-martialed as a number of SEALs are being. I'm going to defend them. I'm going to send money to their defense, by the way. I'm trying to find out who they are, where they are, who's defending them, and what kind of money they need. I can guarantee you I'll be there for them as I was with some of the Marines. But let's turn to this today. And let's ask ourselves, why is he sending more troops? Virginia Mark, go ahead, please. Why is Obama sending more troops to Afghanistan?
Man, your question's just as good as mine, man. I was for Obama, and last time I checked, during the presidential candidate, you know, campaign, he said, you know, he was anti-war. So, I mean, we ain't going to do nothing.
Look, Mark, let's forget whether you're a Democrat or I'm not. What is he doing here? Why is he doing this?
Could be, you know, just for publicity. Just, you know, maybe think he's doing something when he really not.
I don't know, my friend. But, Mark, thank you for listening to this show. That's all I want to say. Thanks for having the guts to listen to this show. You know, it actually takes courage to listen to my show and to admit it to people. Everyone hides it. This is sort of like a show for Muranos in America. You know what a Murano is? Years ago, I explained it. During the Inquisition in Spain in the Middle Ages, you had to be a Christian or you were crucified or expelled from the country. So Muslims were driven out, Jews were driven out of Spain, but many Jews chose to stay in Spain as hidden Jews, and they became Catholics on the outside, but they would practice the religion of Judaism secretly, and they were known as Muranos. And I used this term about 6 years ago to describe conservatives who hide their conservatism, whether it be in Hollywood or in liberal counties or towns, and they call themselves Murano conservatives because they're ashamed to admit it, frankly. But when it comes to a thing like war, I mean, I don't think this is a conservative or liberal question, and that is because the liberals are opposed to this war, but they're opposed to all war. So I discount their opposition to this war. It means no meaning for me. If they were opposed to this war but in favor of a war when necessary, I would say, okay, they have validity. But if you're opposed to all war, then you're crazy. That's like saying I'm opposed to guns. That makes no sense. Okay? 1-800. Could you play Hallelujah, the big one? I keep hearing it in my head. Why am I hearing Hallelujah, Hallelujah, whatever? Denver, Colorado. Joe, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hallelujah.
That's the one.
Give a moment here. Thank you for taking my call, Michael.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to thank you for sending me a copy of Banned in Britain. I haven't gotten it yet. And if you'd allow me, I'd like to do something for you. I'd like to do an oil painting of Teddy for you. I'm a dog lover. So,
Are you a professional painter?
Well, I get money for doing it, but this is just I'm a graduate.
Hey, I'd love it. I don't care if you're an amateur painter. Paint Teddy. By the way, his picture can be seen on the front of Psychological Nudity. Is that a good enough picture to work from?
Well, you know, I don't want any money or anything, or you can send it wherever you want.
All right, stay on the line. We'll get it to you. That's all. It's like I'm going to get every artist now. Had a weird request the other day came into my lawyer because I don't have an address anyone could write to or an email address. I don't receive any listener emails because I once had that, you know, open email chain. We'd get 2,000 a day. I needed two people working all day long. 90% of them are just, you know, mass emails. And the rest are hate mail, and you get an occasional email that hasn't been. I just cut off the flow, that's all. But one slipped through, I'm not going to tell you how. And a guy says, I'm a 14-year-old Muslim, and I would like to visit you because I'm doing a thing on leadership in America. I said, guy, great, that's real old. That's like a number one rule is, this didn't sound legitimate, number one. And it goes back to what I learned in radio on day one, which was never accept listener gifts in the form of food. Dear Mike, I love you so much that I baked you this special cake. Dear Mike, John and I loved you so much we bottled this wine just for you. Dear Mike, please enjoy this kielbasa that we made for you. It's made from the finest ingredients. Well, we don't accept listener food, nor do we accept listener requests for in-person interviews for obvious reasons. Now, play Hallelujah again for a minute. Now, that's great Euro music. I realize that many of you don't like it because it doesn't have a beat and it doesn't talk about abusing women or police. It doesn't have that kind of, you know, beat that you can you know, hold your pants up to kind of thing. But it was written when men still had belts around their trousers and still had dignity left in the world. Play it again. No, I don't want to do it again. I'm bored already. I could see already I'm hitting a dead end. I'm hitting a dead end because I'm tired of this already. There are 95,000 Afghan troops at present. The U.S. wants that number up to 134. It's Vietnam all over again. I mean, it's LBJ's Vietnam syndrome all over again. We may as well have McNamara running the Defense Department because there's so much money involved. You don't understand this. Defense secretaries are not warriors, by and large. They're businessmen. They're lobbyists for defense contractors. Do you have any idea what kind of money is made on war? Have you any idea what kind of money is made on contracts? If you did, your hair would... Who's going to pay for this war? Am I allowed to bring up that question? Do you actually believe that our men are going to be able to train the so-called Afghan army and the Afghan police? And let me remind you, just 3 weeks ago, a so-called ally, an Afghan policeman, killed four British Special Forces operatives on a rooftop. He was supposedly on their side, and he shot them in the head and disappeared into the wilderness. I'm telling you, this is bad. I'm telling you, this is bad. He's a war president. I do not know whether that, I mean, look, let's be honest. The only reason Obama's doing this, the number one reason, is for political reasons. Let's start with that. Let's put everything else aside, okay? And I believe it's all about whether or not he can win a second term already, because public opinion in the U.S. is turning against the war in the face of mounting casualties, a lack of faith in the stooge Karzai. I mean, Karzai basically is a puppet. You know he's just a puppet there, right? What are we propping up this guy for? What are we doing there? Nobody has a straight answer, you know? Now, if you've got a straight answer, go ahead, call me. Harold in New York on WOR. What would you say about the Afghan war over there? Would you send your child to die there?
Here's what I have to say to you. First of all, it's all about money. This is number one. That's why he wants to go there. Second of all, a lot of people I know listen to your show. I have it on in the store and the radio. People come in, they listen to it. Now, the main point.
Wait, hold it. That's more interesting to me than the war. What kind of store?
I have a locksmith shop in Manhattan near the UN. I called you already a half a dozen times.
Is it a good, do you make a good locks? Is it Nova? Okay, come on. You've heard every joke in the book. Sorry. All right, so you're near the UN. You have a locksmith store. You play the show. Tell me what's going on with people on the Afghan war.
All right, you want to know what's going on with people in the Afghan war?
Yes, locksmiths know everything.
Tell you what's going on with people in the Afghan war. I would say that most people are against it. I have a son. Here's why I called you. I have a son. Yeah. I usually do midget stories with you, but I'm not going to do comedy today. My son is 19. 19.
Yes.
All right? Kid graduated college a year and a half ago, did 1 year. Kid graduated high school a year and a half ago, did 1 year of college. Last year, he wanted to talk to a Marine recruiter. It's his decision. Okay, I went with him to the Marine recruiter.
Right.
He was thinking about it.
Right.
He listens to you all the time, by the way.
Okay.
What turns him off to this are the rules of engagement. He understands. He realizes. They'll put a weapon.
He knows. Did he enlist in the Marines or didn't he?
No, he has not. Not yet, but he's still thinking about it.
But he's afraid that if he goes over there, gung-ho, does his job, he'll wind up with a court-martial. Isn't that reality?
That is absolutely correct.
That's the problem number. That's one problem. Either we go to win or we don't go at all. That's my position. Does that make me an extremist or a realist, Harold?
Makes you a realist, not an extremist. They'll put a weapon in my son's hand. They'll ask him to defend his country, and then they'll prosecute him for defending his country.
That's how I see it. That's what they've done now for 10 years, since at least 7-8 years. George Bush put in rules of engagement that have made it almost impossible for our Marines to do the job they're trained to do. Period. End of story. You know, Colonel Chesani is still facing charges. They won't let that thing go. Why? It wasn't even on the battlefield. It was a bogus case brought up by a left-wing stooge from one of the MAGA Time magazine. And this is the kind of war they're fighting.
Is why my son is reluctant.
This Harold, you've seen all of the war movies, all of the footage from World War II. Do you realize by today's standards, virtually every soldier who fought in World War II would be tried for war crimes?
I realize that. I understand it. My father was a World War II veteran. We used to sit and talk about this.
Where did he fight, Harold? What theater, so to speak?
My father was in the Pacific. My father was in Africa. My father was all over Europe.
Well, did you ever see the footage of the Okinawa campaigns or the Tarawa, where they had to use flamethrowers toward the end to get the Japanese to come out of the caves? Tell me what happened to a Marine who used a flamethrower today. Today they would tell him from Washington he's got to go in there and talk to them in Japanese to ask them to come out. Offer them perhaps some sushi.
You know what's going to happen. You know what's going to happen. They're going to try him. This is what's going to happen. They're going to try him for doing his job.
Okay, so now look, you're a locksmith in New York. Let's now come down to brass tacks. Locksmiths are practical people. You analyze a lock. When you have to open a lock you don't have a key for, you have to use analytical skills, correct, to open that lock?
Correct, correct. Come on.
No, you see, already you know the chess game. I could see already you figured it out. So let's use common sense together. Why is Obama going into Afghanistan if intuitive? Politically, the guy is a dove. He's a left-winger, anti-war. Why is he doing it?
You see, now, I don't agree with you. I don't think it's political. I think it's all business. It's all money. This is all about the money. I just can't put it all together where, how the fat cats on top make out on this one. But it's all about the money.
Well, I'll tell you what. If Goldman Sachs, if we find out that they got their snouts in industries or businesses that will benefit from this, will that help you? You and I can figure it out. Well, let's say, and we don't know if this is true, General Electric is going to make something for the war effort, and the contracts will total hundreds of billions of dollars. Would that make sense?
Of course it would make sense, but who gets sacrificed in the end? Like always, it's the kids.
Oh, you think they care about cannon fodder like your son?
No, I know they don't. I know they don't. I know they don't.
Well, Harold, it's a very sad time when we have a war like this that we can't win. And the reason we can't win is because no one knows how to fight it. No one really knows why we're there. It's kind of halfway there. We have to be there, but we don't know why. And we don't have to be there. We don't know why. So let's stay there and let's see a few more thousand men die and get maimed. Have you seen any of the TV shows of the kind of injuries the guys are coming back with who do survive these roadside bombs? Their faces are missing.
Yeah,
they have 50 surgeries to put a face back on them. I saw that last week. I was shocked. I couldn't believe what I was watching.
Yes, I saw. I saw. I read about it. I saw, yes.
And then if this, what about the fact that we saw 2 weeks ago, and I think I'm the only one continuing to report this, 4 or 5 Navy SEALs captured a terrorist after a gun battle, and they slapped them around, and they're being court-martialed. Did you hear that one, Harold?
Yes, of course. I heard it. I'm ready to jump out through the radio. This is driving me berserk. They're doing their job. They're prosecuting them for doing their job.
Well, Harold, I don't know what to say other than you're a realist, not an extremist, as I consider myself to be. But since your son is thinking of going into the Marines, let me send him Band in Britain so he knows what it's like to be an innocent victim of a smear campaign. Stay on the line. I'll be right back.
Savage.
It is 55 minutes after the hour. You're listening to The Syncopated Savage. I remember hearing this when I was young. I love this. The early show, yum, steak, French fries, cherry vanilla ice cream in front of the television. While poor dad was working as hard as he could to make sure that I could be a fat little boy sitting and eating ice cream and steak. Till one day dad came home white from the trip from Manhattan. And I heard the yells and screams in the kitchen. The next thing I knew, those days were over. Toughen the kid up! You're making him too soft! And that was the end of the syncopated clock. Now, the question is, Afghanistan, should we get out or get in? I believe that there's no way to win here. What are you going to do, nuke the whole nation and pave it over? I mean, you're not going to win here. I think the war is hopeless. The military option that they're using that you're going to hear about tonight is let's fall back on the cities. Now, what do you mean by let's fall back on the cities? Well, that's what the Russians did before they were thrown out. That is what the U.S. did in Vietnam. It will not work in Afghanistan. It will not work in Afghanistan. The fact is that NATO has high-tech weapons, but you cannot defeat the Taliban unless you go out into the countryside with scope rifles. And I don't know that there's enough of the people to do that. How are you going to get the Taliban to turn around? How is it possible? There's no argument for this. So I don't really know where they're coming from. I think the decision that he is making tonight is an agonized decision, no question about it. Put aside his politics and his questionable background. Put aside all of that of Obama. But this decision that he came to is one based upon the military-industrial complex as well as the media industrial complex. There's $1 billion a day interest in the continuance of this war. Let's call it like it is. It's all about money. Wars are generally about territory, which is always about money. Remember that. Remember, wars are always about money. In fact, if you look back at Iraq, where we still are, by the way, we were lied to by Bush when he said this war will cost us nothing because they will pay us in oil. He was lying. Where's the oil? I didn't see the oil because they don't want the prices suppressed. So here comes a 10-year battle in the mountains and plains of Afghanistan. What is going to happen at the end of it is we're going to be broken like the Soviet Union. This war, if you think we're bankrupt now, and we likely are, we're living on paper money, this war will put the final death knell to this country's economy. There is no way that this war is going to be won. And number two, there's no way the war can be paid for without totally bankrupting the middle class. I have no idea why we are in Afghanistan. In that regard, I say get out, not get in.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Welcome to the Savage Nation. We're playing the Syncopated Clock by Leroy Anderson, made famous by CBS and their series The Late Show, not The Early Show, back in the early 50s. So I don't know, it was in my head last night. Why, I don't know, the Syncopated Clock, Leroy Anderson, amazing. So look, we're talking about whether to get out or get into Afghanistan because Obama's speech is tonight, and we know what it's going to say, 30,000 more troops, and we'll be out by 2013. And the fact of the matter is, it's a zero-sum game. We're going to leave with our tail between our legs. There's no way to win there. I have no idea why we're there. I keep saying to you again, why are the neocons, so-called, panting for this again? Why do these guys want our men in Afghanistan? Why are guys like the character from the Weekly Standard? He looks like a schleppy nice guy whose father got him where he is. He has no real verve. He knows he doesn't have to fight over there. Why does he want Mr. and Mrs. Smith's son to go to Kabul? Why are Rush and the wall bangers so gung-ho for war when they know that they or their children don't have to go? Rush has no children, obviously. Well, what's this all about? What is this all about? What's the foaming stuff here, like we got to go to Afghanistan or else what? The counterinsurgency, we're going to have counterinsurgency, and that's going to fight terrorism. Some say it's two different things. Some say that equating counterinsurgency to counterterrorism is insanity. The fact of the matter is, it's not the same thing. And I must tell you that if you read the history of Britain and Afghanistan, it's terrible. If you look at what happened to the great Russian military in Afghanistan, it may be a predictor of what's going to happen to our military in Afghanistan. And moreover, I got to tell you something else. If you want to put two and two together, Russia fell after their loss in Afghanistan. It was like the Goliath finally hit its dead end and it collapsed. The Soviet Union fell apart after they lost in Afghanistan. They couldn't hold it together. I fear for this country's future, by the way, by this ludicrous war mania. Now, let me explain to you that there are justifiable wars, just as there are justifiable homicides, justifiable self-defense. I don't see it here. If you do, please explain to me and sell me on it. We're also talking about Tiger Woods, and all the women coming out of the closet now saying that they were his girlfriends. Who knows? They're just gold diggers or whatever. And the cocktail waitress, that's sort of an oxymoron, from New York that he allegedly had a relationship with that set his Swedish wife off with the golf club in the window, has a weird name that we're trying to figure out what the name is. I don't know what it is. Frank in New York, you're calling about the alleged girlfriend's last name. Frank, what is it? What's the ethnicity?
It's a Czech name, Michael. It means teacher.
What's the name in Czech?
Who should tell? It means teacher. Except
she's some teacher, boy, I'll tell you.
Yeah, it's an anglicized version. They would use just a C in Czech because the C has a modified hook on it to make a ch sound. But it's a Czech name. It means teacher.
Yeah, she certainly had a hook on it, I guarantee you. But so the Czech is the new Swede, by the way, amongst young guys. The Czechs today are what the Swedes were in the 50s. You know that?
Yeah, I'm familiar with Czech myself.
You see that? At 18, your knees go weak, I hear. Then you wake up at 28 after you marry. They look like Stalin's housekeeper.
They age pretty well.
How does that happen? Why do so many of those women? I know this is true with the Ukrainians. At 18, the men go, their knees go weak. They go crazy. Then they marry them. 10 years later, they wish they were dead. As I said, they look like Stalin's housekeeper with a babushka. They put on 100 pounds. What is this about the Czech women? The same thing?
Yeah, they kind of... They turn, but it's got to be diet, I guess, you know, in the older way. It was just potatoes and dumplings and...
Yeah, well, of course, the potato skins, but there's no excuse for that here. I don't know what it is. Who knows? But a lot of women, they starve themselves to catch a man, and then they don't have to anymore. This used to be true of many ethnic groups in New York when we were kids. We would laugh about it. 17, 18, the girls could take your heart away. They were like out of Romeo and Juliet. And then 6 years later in Far Rockaway, they had a mustache already and put on 75 pounds. Do I hear a giggle in the background, Frank, or was that somebody coughing?
I'm giggling a little bit. I haven't gotten up there in those ages ranges yet.
Oh, you're a youngster yet. You don't know what's waiting for you. All right, enjoy the fantasy. What am I laughing about? Why am I laughing? There's nothing funny about that. We're talking about war and peace here, and now we're laughing about love and marriage, which no longer go together like a horse and carriage. So in order to replace a population, you need 2.1 children per couple. Let's start with that figure. The birth rate in America amongst whites is, I think, 1.7 or 1.6. The birth rate amongst illegal immigrants is like 19.6. Okay, that's an exaggeration. We know that. All right, put it on a paper and send it around the world now. You get the picture. And that should make the liberals very happy. They think they're going to wind up on top. Yeah, they'll wind up on top. So here we are, post-Thanksgiving, you know, blues day on the Savage Nation. The president of the United States of America are in such trouble politically amongst anyone with a brain. You got ClimateGate blew up in their face, and they're going ahead with it like nothing happened, even though the top guy in the climate lie has stepped down, so to speak, in the United Kingdom. Obama's still going to Copenhagen with this nonsense. You know, if ever there was an issue where the man could show some decency of character and some genuine independence and intelligence, it would be the climate situation, where the man could say, you know what, we were duped. Al Gore is a liar. He doesn't even have to say that. He could say that the scientists may have fudged the data. I'm withdrawing from this debate until we have all the evidence in. That would give the guy a 10-point boost amongst the intelligent people of America. And with regard to Afghanistan, there is a way out of this. He doesn't have to send 30,000 more troops to stay there till 2013. He could go in there and he could say, we're going to withdraw after we do X, Y, and Z, and we're going to be out in 6 months. We're going to do it strategically. We're going to leave behind certain fortresses. We're going to use the manned, the unmanned drones or whatever. We're going to use increased intelligence. We're going to cooperate with the Pakistani army. But we're going to get out of there. We don't want anything to do with occupation, because we've analyzed that occupation generally stirs up more terrorism. It doesn't suppress it. It stirs it up. And many of the terrorists who are coming out of the Pashtun regions, if you study this in great detail, would have nowhere to go. They would no longer have the justification of an occupying force that they're uniting behind. You understand that? I believe the Afghan war is futile. The Taliban are the lowest on the planet. However, why are we there? I mean, why are we there? No one can answer that question. So here we are. Here we have the brightest president in American history, and they have no idea what to do in Afghanistan except to plunge more young men into their deaths, to their deaths. Okay? So, do you know who said this? We no longer need rely on bringing death, destruction, and exile to hundreds of thousands of foreigners in the faint belief that this might stop a few bombs going off back home. Who wrote that? Well, a British leftist wrote it. Is he right? Is he right when he says we no longer need to rely on bringing death, destruction, and exile to hundreds of thousands of foreigners in the faint belief that this might stop a few bombs going off back home? And I want to remind you of something else that's come out. 3 million Iraqis have been driven into exile as a result of the Iraq war, and that includes almost all of Iraq's Christians who have been driven out by the Friends of America, the Shia who took over the country. They drove the Christians out of the country. George Bush doesn't want you to know that. It's part of his legacy. And I believe all the Christians will be driven out of Afghanistan as well. And where are they going to go? Are we going to take them in as well? Where does this end? What an agony this is. Now, I realize we didn't start this war. But the question is, how many corpses, how many body bags is this going to take until the rallying cry is over? When is this going to end? What are we doing there? New York, Brian, go ahead. You're in favor of going in, correct?
Reason we're there is, as I told the other guy, we got to be battle ready. Is China battling a war? Is Russia battling a war right now? No.
What are you saying? We're using Afghanistan as a training ground?
Pretty much, yeah. We're always going to be at war. From this point on, we're always going to be at war. There's going to be a war somewhere where we're going to send our troops because they're going to be battle ready. It's 10 to 1. Battle ready. South Africa. You know World War II.
Well, okay. Let's use that analogy for a moment. I am sorry to tell you that China has, I believe, 30 million excess males in the population, young males. You know that, don't you?
Yes, yes.
Did you hear the number, though, 30 million?
Down Red Square, right?
Now, why would China have had a family policy which would produce excessive young men, an excess of young men?
Well,
no, I think you can pretty much put two and two together. And these men are as hard as rocks. They can live on very little food. They have no sense of sensibilities that we can equate with here in the United States of America. Tell me what kind of battle we can win against China with the rules of engagement we have as opposed to the rules of engagement that they might have. You know, this is a very, very dark scenario, Brian.
They're going to pick their spot. There is going to be a spot where we're going to go up to China, go up against the Chinese.
Well, that's interesting. What spot might that be? Obama has basically thrown Tibet to the wolves. He just went to China and said basically Tibet is part of China, it's over. And Richard Gere had nothing to say. All of the Free Tibet people were suddenly silent. What in the world could we possibly fight with China over? What?
Well, it's a mountainous region. Is it not almost like Afghanistan a little bit?
No, I don't know where we might fight them, certainly. It could be in any terrain, but over what? What would the fight be over?
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Well, it's a pretty cynical scenario that you're laying out, which is that the military is going to expend the lives of men just to keep them battle ready. I mean, that's pretty amazing.
I used to be, when I was younger, I used to be, I was going to go to Russia and, check it out and whatnot. And no. Now I'm a little older. I realize what's going on. That's what's going on.
All right, let's hope that you're not right. I don't think that that's the reason behind it. I personally think it's far more mercenary on an immediate front. I think the $1 billion a day of graft in running this war is what it's all about. And by the way, if there's a smart person out there who wants to do some research, if you want to become a, let us say, researcher for the Savage Nation, why don't you research the top 10 companies that are going to benefit from the war in Afghanistan and tell me where their stocks are going to be tomorrow? Because you can make a lot of money by investing in them tonight, okay? Look it up. Somebody must have done the analysis. Name the top 10 companies that are going to benefit from a war in Afghanistan. And I can guarantee you they're all donors to Obama. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Crazier by the second. Death and destruction. It's horrible. You don't know which way to turn anymore. These are not good times. I mean, on the one hand, yes, you know, the best of times is the worst of times. In many ways, it's like all other times. I understand that. But here we are about to plunge into Afghanistan now for 5 more years. God knows they're saying, you know, it's like the government says the health care is going to cost $1 trillion when you know it's $10 trillion. They say they're going to be out of Afghanistan by 2013. You know that's a lie. So the British did not defeat the Afghani tribes. Who did? Jim in San Antonio, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Doc. Well, Alexander the Great was the first one to take them on, and the way he did it was he married into the local royalty. And
oh,
the
well, there you go. Well, Obama has the lead there. There you go. I don't think Michelle would like that very much.
Well, the way Alexander would, he also did subdue the guerrilla tactics of the tribes that rose up against him was he starved them. He cut off all his food supplies.
How inhumane. I suppose the UN would object to that one.
Well, the other successful invaders were the Mongols, who, once they passed through there, made some treaties, and as soon as they left, their emissaries were murdered by the Afghans. It's very treacherous. They turned around and wiped out the city of Herat, killed close to 400,000 people.
They killed every man, woman, and child, didn't they?
Yes, sir, they did. And it was a very effective strategy because they had...
Well, the last time that strategy was used by the United States was to stop Japan in World War II. I mean, let's be real. Truman knew it would take 500,000 to 1 million more American lives to conquer the homeland of Japan, and he made the horrendous decision, but he made it, to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki, causing untold death and destruction on the civilian population as well, Jim. But that ended the war. We have been mired in Iraq and in Afghanistan because we do not have the capacity to conduct ourselves in that manner anymore, Jim.
Well, we don't use the Air Force either, which is the greatest tactical weapon we have.
I agree with you. I 1,000% agree with you. What is our strategic advantage? It's in air power, not used. Are we using main battle tanks? Well, how can you use them in the mountains? That's the next question. Let's go back to air power. Let's not be armchair generals and be fools about it. They used air power to try and take Okinawa and Tarawa, and it only had a limited result. The Japanese were so well dug into mountain caves that it took Marines going in hand-to-hand combat to get them out. You know that as well. So really, what has changed in that regard?
The velocity of the weaponry. We have bombs now that could level mountains. I mean, we have bunker bombs. We have a semi-nuclear.
All right, that's true. So there are rockets that can penetrate cave walls and go 200 feet inside the mountain and blow up and collapse the cave system and kill them by starving them out.
70,000.
Why aren't we using air power? What is it? We're afraid of collateral damage?
I think it's the stigma of picking on the...
Well, here's Obama. It's now Obama's war, and that's the end of it. He can't lay it on George Bush's lap anymore. It's the Obama fanatics have had enough of this already.
Savage.
Let's start from the top again now. You've been listening to this on the war, in or out, right? Now, you've heard me say that I can't see any reason to stay there. I want you to understand that many of you are probably confused by what I'm saying, or you don't know where I'm coming from, because you say, wait a minute, anti-war groups are planning protests against the escalation. And Michael Savage, how can he be aligned with these radical left-wing groups? Well, I'm not aligned with them. I'm an independent thinker. And I'm telling you that from my point of view as an independent, it doesn't make sense to me. I'm not aligned with anybody. But then you have to ask yourself, why are so many neocons who whipped up war fever for Iraq continuing to whip up war fever for Afghanistan when they themselves are not going to go over there and fight and die or get maimed? That's the part of it that bothers me. I also said before the last break that the money is the whole issue. And I asked you to look up the defense industry players who are going to benefit from. Well, we have the answer for you. The top five defense industry contributors during the 08 elections were Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, and Raytheon and General Dynamics, right? And who did they give the money to? Well, they gave it to federal candidates. The fact of the matter is, you've got to take a look very carefully. The President Obama, he may be showing disloyalty to his political base in their mind, but he's very loyal to the defense industry interests that were part of his funding. For example, the top recipient of defense industry money in the 08 election cycle was not McCain. It was Barack Obama, whose haul was $1,029,000, far surpassing Republican contender McCain's $696,000. During the 08 cycle, the defense industry contributed a total of $23 million to federal candidates, far more than the $17 million it invested in the 06 cycle. And the top five defense industry contributors during the 08 elections were Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, and General Dynamics. And their investment is paying off. In fact, I would say to you, you want to make some money, invest in these companies tonight. I don't have a dime in any of them. I don't even play the stock market. But if you do, I can guarantee you as I sit here, their stock's going to jump tomorrow. That's all. And I'm not an insider. Just put two and two together. It's awful, isn't it? Why? Well, the Defense Department's going to need precision munitions, communications gear, helicopters, armor, surveillance systems. And so there you go. And that's it. The military-industrial complex. Now, the first president to warn us about this was General Eisenhower, who was the Supreme Allied Commander in World War II. And he himself had been a very distinguished military man in World War I. He wasn't like our defense secretaries of today, nor was he, he wasn't a defense secretary, he was the Supreme Allied Commander. But he wasn't like the commanders that we have today who generally have no war experience. General Eisenhower, who led the Allies to victory in World War II, particularly, as you know, the invasion of Normandy, the most complex invasion in human history, said after the war in the 50s, beware the government, the military-industrial complex. Beowulf, do we have that soundbite?
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
Bingo.
The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
He was a prophet. Now, that was not coming from far-left code stinko. This was not a communist ACLUer. This was a battle-hardened warrior going back to World War I, led the troops in World War II. And here he was warning about what he saw happening in the 1950s already. So, ladies and gentlemen, I rest my case. I have, in essence, presented a case that is a difficult one for me to present before you today. The question before you was, in a way, not who's guilty and who's innocent. It's not about that. I said, Afghanistan in or out. I made it simple. And I rest my case and say it's time to get out, not get more deeply in. Of course, I have no influence. I have said other things that made great sense. I've come up with ideas that have good sense. None of them ever have any play in the American political system, which is why there are so many millions of independents who are alienated from the political class, who are functioning as though they are Whigs in old England. They may as well be wearing perfumed wigs for a lot of good our democracy does us, we the people. So I'll take your calls right now. Waterbury, Connecticut. Nick, you're on the Savage Nation. Your opinion counts. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Doc. You know, these people that are in charge now, they protested the Vietnam War. Now, all of a sudden, they're sending troops over to Afghanistan. And trying to get enemies that are in mountains are impossible. I've seen mountains napalm that you wouldn't believe anything can live in. An hour later, they'd be mortaring, sending rockets out of that same area that you napalmed. I can't understand.
Nick, are you talking about in Vietnam?
Yes.
Were you over there?
Yes.
And you're saying that we dropped napalm on mountain hideouts and it made no difference?
Station in Phan Rang, at maybe a mile from our base, there was a mountain. We called it Charlie's Mountain. We would get mortars. They would shoot mortars and rockets to our base, you know, trying to actually cause a lot of disturbance. The F-100s would take off and just napalm that mountain. I mean, it would light up and just burn for hours. And when that fire went out, the mortars start all over again. The rockets start all over again. I don't know how I don't know what they had in the mountains. They were able to survive in those mountains, no matter what you do to them.
So here you are, Nick, an ex-military. I mean, you were a combat guy in Vietnam. And so which side are you on with regard to this? Are you for more troops or get out now?
Get out.
I would say that a good percentage, if not all of the – well, not all. All of nobody, you could say. I'd say up to the 90th percentile of ex – let's start with Vietnam. Men who fought in Vietnam, I bet 90% of them would say, don't escalate. Get out of there. I'll bet you that's what would happen with them.
Right.
So who's gung-ho? Tell me who's gung-ho for this, Nick.
Who's gung-ho? Everybody in charge in the Pentagon. Half of them were protesting the war during the Vietnam. They're out protesting. Now they're sitting there deciding, well, let's send guys over there. I can't understand the way they think.
Well, that's right, because their boss told them what to say, and what he says, they go along with all of the women in the military, in the Defense Department. I see them, I want to puke.
Well, you know, we had 500,000 troops in Vietnam when I was there, and we still lost the war. How?
Nick, how did the Soviet Union get their butts kicked in Afghanistan is what you have to ask yourself. How did a military that was so powerful, with attack helicopters that were called, I think, the Dragon. You ever see those dragons in the movies?
Yeah.
I mean, they're awesome. What if you were a guerrilla fighter in the Afghani hills fighting with your son and your grandfather in a ragtag army with a couple of weapons? Maybe you had Stinger missiles that the U.S. gave you, living on God knows what, camel dung, and you see one of these hunter-killer helicopters come over a mountain pass facing you down in a village. How did they win against the Soviet Union?
They take it out with a Stinger missile. They would do anything they could to take out that helicopter.
Right. Now you have to ask yourself, why were these men such ferocious fighters? Why were they so willing to die in such great numbers to drive the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan? That's the number one question. Because nothing has changed, by the way. Only instead of the Soviets, the Americans are now the invaders. That's how they see it. I don't think they even care who the Taliban or the Al-Qaeda are generally. In the country region, I don't believe that's as big an issue as it is in the cities. But the fact of the matter is, they see the Americans as an occupying force that must be driven out of their homeland. I only wish the Americans had the same love of land as the Afghanis do, by the way.
Well, you know, it'd be like if we were getting invaded here, Doc, we would do the same thing.
Wait, you say we? Who's the we? The very people that this government fears and hates? The ex-military armed to the teeth? The police armed to the teeth? The conservatives armed to the teeth? They would fight, but I can guarantee you the fifth column in the media and the fifth column in the government would undermine any defense within this country against an invading force. I can guarantee you they would become quislings and collaborators within 3 months.
Hey, Doc, I don't think they'd last long. I really don't.
Well, we'll have to let it go at that, Nick. I'm really honored that you listened to the show, and I'm going to send you a copy of, you know, if you're listening to a show this late at night, it's like 7:45 on the East Coast. You're waiting for Obama's speech, as we all are. But we, the people, are talking about it in advance. We know it's a given that they're going to go in deeper, right? So, Nick, let me send you a copy of Bannon Britain as a gift. You're getting a holiday gift. That's all. New York, Jimmy, go ahead. You're on OR. WOR calls. Go ahead, please.
Yes, when the Soviets were in Afghanistan, they kidnapped between 30 and 40,000 young guys, brought them back to the Soviet Union for training. We don't know where they ended up, but I suspect that they're the leaders now in Afghanistan fighting America. A lot of former former communists are now imams throughout the former Soviet stands, the Muslim republics. You have the Reverend Ben Chavez, head of the NAACP. He was a communist. He worked with Carl Braden from the Communist Party. He's now a radical Muslim. So this is the new...
What? Wait, say that again. Who became a radical Muslim? Ben Braden?
Ben Chavez.
Ben Chavez.
Headed the NAACP for a while, too. He had a sex scandal. He took some of the money to pay off.
Oh, I see. Now he got he found the holy out.
He became a Farrakhan Muslim. But before that, I see.
Well, that's a good place to go with the bow tie.
Well, before that, in the communist newspapers, he was talking about uniting poor youth across America. That was about the same time Gaddafi was talking about spending $1 billion in America to organize the youth, which turned out now it's George Soros doing that.
Oh, God, don't get me started with George Soros. That man is Dr. Evil, as far as I'm concerned.
KGB. This is the still communist movement going on.
Do you think that George Soros is benefiting from this war effort financially?
He might be, but a Marxist is not financial is the number one thing.
What do you mean? He's one of the richest men on earth. He's a speculator. You're telling me he doesn't have his fingers in some of the pies that are going to benefit from this as well? You know, if you can advance your ideology and make more money, how much better does it get?
Oh, that's it. They're using capital.
And to be invited into the White House like an honored guest?
Well, they're using capitalism to build communism. This is what they say in their own writings. We're just so stupid.
Who was it? Which of the communists, Jimmy, you're an expert, who said that when the last capitalist is hung, he'll be hung with the rope he manufactured? Was that Karl Marx?
Well, Lenin. Lenin said that. But that's kind of a usual thing among communists. They all know it. The only people who don't know it are us, we the people. In other words, if you don't know your enemy, you can't win. So
you don't know your enemy. The enemy is within the White House, as far as I'm concerned. Take a look at his sacred cabinet there. The unelected Marxists surrounding Obama. What, have we forgot about them all of a sudden? All these czars? I mean, what do you mean czar? How could you use the word czar and not be seen for what you are? And by the way, you're talking about communism. You wanted me to flare up your paranoia. Here we have an election in Honduras the other day, buried by the government media complex, where the conservative wins again. And who does Obama and Hillary back? They want Zelaya, the communist, to return to power for the rest of his term. Why is Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama backing a communist who was thrown out by the people of Honduras? What's that all about?
Well, Hillary Clinton is a long-term Marxist or Marxoid. Obama is a total Marxist. And by the way, I don't have paranoia. I have knowledge. Some people confuse the two.
Well, Jimmy, as usual, a pleasure to speak to you. Thanks for calling. It is 45. You know what time it is already? It's 47 minutes after the hour, and you're listening to the Savage Nation. Back in a minute.
Savage.
Well, you're about to hear President Obama's speech. You know what it's going to say, 30,000 more troops. But let me ask you something. What about the army of contractors in Afghanistan? Do you know anything about that? We have an article just received from Talking Points Memo that says the number of contractors in Afghanistan as of June was 73,000 compared with 55,000 troops. Did you hear the number? 55,000 troops, 73,000 some odd contractors. Who is going to pay for this? I mean, they outnumber the size of the U.S. troop presence. Now, there are some problems with the word contractor, such as who are they? Well, the majority of contractors are Afghan nationals, and they do the work that makes the war possible, such as serving food. Remember, military used to have chefs, no more. Driving trucks, constructing buildings, transporting fuel, and more, right? But how many of them are liable to become guys who frag our own troops, meaning kill them? Sure, it gives the U.S. ability to fight wars with fewer American troops. More can be put into combat. That may be good or bad. But what about the fact of the matter is how much it costs, number one? Number two, it invites waste, fraud, and abuse of taxpayer money, right? Because the U.S. military should be doing many of these jobs. And number three, what about the contractors who are not loyal to the military efforts? What if they become enemy themselves? What if the enemy slips some in as contractors? What about that? So this is a different world than World War II. It's different than Vietnam. This is something that has arisen with the lack of a draft and the advent of an all-volunteer military. I, for one, believe that the draft should be reinstituted in the United States of America if we're going to be fighting the Islamic threat around the world. I mean, let's talk with each other real. They're on the warpath all over the world, the radical Muslims. You want to call it like it is? Not one word tonight will say anything about Islam and Muslims. And that's because most of the Muslims in the world want them defeated as well. I mean, let's be clear. Finish the whole sentence, by the way, if you quote me. Quote me correctly. The majority of Muslims, the majority now, not all, probably want to be left alone to practice their own lives, practice their own religion. And they are victims of these Taliban as well. Okay, let's be clear about that. But unfortunately, there's a very sizable minority of Muslims who are on the warpath who would like to take over the world. And they believe they have victory on that. They can smell victory because they see the weakness of the West. They wake up and they see British women puking on themselves in the gutters of England. They see the white people not reproducing in America and England. They see what wimps the Americans, the Brits, by and large, the Germans, the French have become, the Italians, no children, no family, no willingness to fight. And so what would you do if you were a fanatic? You'd fight even harder. And so as I say to you, the people who are running this country, they know what's at stake. They know what the war is all about. Sure, there's greed, graft, and corruption, as we've told you, going back to the beginning of the first war, probably. And Eisenhower warned us about the military-industrial complex. But behind it all, there are some very hard-nosed, rational people who understand that our way of life is being threatened by radical Islamists. There is no question about it. And if we're going to be in a 100 years war, which is just very possible, by the way, it's very possible we're going to be fighting Islamic insurgencies for the next century. Why? It can't happen? It can happen. It's likely to happen. If you believe that we're going to be out of Afghanistan in 2013 and that's going to be the end of it, then you're, you know, then you believe in Santa Claus, so to speak. No, we're not going to be out of anywhere. And if we're out of there, we'll be somewhere else. We might have to be in Pakistan to protect the nuclear arsenal from the insurgency that might sweep over that country. God only knows what could happen. I guarantee you the Defense Department already has a contingency plan of what happens if the nightmare scenario, Al-Qaeda or the Taliban take over Pakistan. How would you protect the Pakistani nukes from falling into their hands? You know and I know they'd have to send 100,000 American troops into Pakistan. I guarantee you they have that that contingency. So if we're going to be fighting, if this country is going to be fighting, if the world is going to be threatened by Islamic fanaticism for the next 100 years until God knows what happens, then we need a draft. We need it fast. Then you're going to have a democracy again. And then you're going to see a whole different attitude towards the war, both pro and con. Then you're not going to see people in the media who have nothing at stake in terms of children or themselves going over there, who wrap themselves in the flag every day, call themselves patriots, call themselves great Americans, ushering on more war, more destruction, more death, and more horrendous suffering than you could ever imagine upon American boys who are going to go over there and suffer and die for what? And so as I say, think very carefully as you listen to President Obama speak in the next hour and evaluate whether we should go in or pull out. And when you do, get back to me tomorrow because that's all we're going to talk about. It's a big story. It is bigger than a Tiger Woods' wife breaking in the rear window or whatever else came to the platform because there's nothing more horrendous than war. Nothing. Nothing on earth compares to it.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
decision to go into Iraq caused substantial rifts between America and much of the world.
You're listening to President Obama's speech on Afghanistan right here on the Savage Nation.
The Iraq war to an irresponsible end. We will remove our combat brigades from Iraq by the end of next summer, and all of our troops by the end of 2011. That we are doing so is a testament to the character of the men and women in uniform. Thanks to their courage, grit, and perseverance, we have given Iraqis a chance to shape their future, and we are successfully leaving Iraq to its people. But while we've achieved hard-earned milestones in Iraq, the situation in Afghanistan has deteriorated. After escaping across the border into Pakistan in 2001 and 2002, al-Qaeda's leadership established a safe haven there. Although a legitimate government was elected by the Afghan people, it's been hampered by corruption, the drug trade, an underdeveloped economy, and insufficient security forces. Over the last several years, the Taliban has maintained common cause with al-Qaeda, as they both seek an overthrow of the Afghan government. Gradually, the Taliban has begun to control additional swaths of territory in Afghanistan while engaging in increasingly brazen and devastating attacks of terrorism against the Pakistani people. Now, throughout this period, our troop levels in Afghanistan remained a fraction of what they were in Iraq. When I took office, we had just over 32,000 Americans serving in Afghanistan, compared to 160,000 in Iraq at the peak of the war. Commanders in Afghanistan repeatedly asked for support to deal with the reemergence of the Taliban, but these reinforcements did not arrive. And that's why, shortly after taking office, I approved a long-standing request for more troops. After consultations with our allies, I then announced a strategy recognizing the fundamental connection between our war effort in Afghanistan and the extremist safe havens in Pakistan. I set a goal that was narrowly defined as disrupting, dismantling, and defeating al-Qaeda and its extremist allies, and pledged to better coordinate our military and civilian efforts. Since then, we've made progress on some important objectives. High-ranking al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders have been killed, and we've stepped up the pressure on al-Qaeda worldwide. In Pakistan, that nation's army has gone on its largest offensive in years. In Afghanistan, we and our allies prevented the Taliban from stopping a presidential election. And although it was marred by fraud, that election produced a government that is consistent with Afghanistan's laws and constitution. Yet huge challenges remain. Afghanistan is not lost, but for several years it has moved backwards. There's no imminent threat of the government being overthrown, but the Taliban has gained momentum. Al-Qaeda has not reemerged in Afghanistan in the same numbers as before 9/11, but they retain their safe havens along the border. And our forces lack the full support they need to effectively train and partner with Afghan security forces and better secure the population. Our new commander in Afghanistan, General McChrystal, has reported that the security situation is more serious than he anticipated. In short, the status quo is not sustainable. As cadets, you volunteered for service during this time of danger. Some of you fought in Afghanistan. Some of you will deploy there. As your commander-in-chief, I owe you a mission that is clearly defined and worthy of your service. And that's why, after the Afghan voting was completed, I insisted on a thorough review of our strategy. Now, let me be clear. There has never been an option before me that called for troop deployments before 2010. So there has been no delay or denial of resources necessary for the conduct of the war during this review period. Instead, the review has allowed me to ask the hard questions. and to explore all the different options, along with my national security team, our military and civilian leadership in Afghanistan, and our key partners. And given the stakes involved, I owed the American people and our troops no less. This review is now complete. And as Commander-in-Chief, I have determined that it is in our vital national interest to send an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan. After 18 months, our troops will begin to come home. These are the resources that we need to seize the initiative while building the Afghan capacity that can allow for a responsible transition of our forces out of Afghanistan. I do not make this decision lightly. I opposed the war in Iraq precisely because I believe that we must exercise restraint in the use of military force and always consider the long-term consequences of our actions. We have been at war now for 8 years, at enormous cost in lives and resources. Years of debate over Iraq and terrorism have left our unity on national security issues in tatters and created a highly polarized and partisan backdrop for this effort. And having just experienced the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, the American people are understandably focused on rebuilding our economy and putting people to work here at home. Most of all, I know that this decision asks even more of you, a military that, along with your families, has already borne the heaviest of all burdens.
I have a question for those who are gung-ho on this. Would you send your children to fight and die in Afghanistan? That's all you've got to ask yourself, yes or no.
I've read the letters from the parents and spouses of those who deployed. I visited our courageous wounded warriors at Walter Reed. I've traveled to Dover to meet the flag-draped caskets of 18 Americans returning home to their final resting place. I see firsthand the terrible wages of war. If I did not think that the security of the United States and the safety of the American people were at stake in Afghanistan, I would gladly order every single one of our troops home tomorrow. So no, I do not make this decision lightly. I make this decision because I am convinced that our security is at stake in Afghanistan and Pakistan. This is the epicenter of violent extremism practiced by al-Qaeda. It is from here that we were attacked on 9/11, and it is from here that new attacks are being plotted as I speak. This is no idle danger, no hypothetical threat. In the last few months alone, we have apprehended extremists within our borders who were sent here from the border region of Afghanistan and Pakistan to commit new acts of terror. And this danger will only grow if the region slides backwards and al-Qaeda can operate with impunity. We must keep the pressure on al-Qaeda, and to do that, we must increase the stability and capacity of our partners in the region. Of course, this burden is not ours alone to bear. This is not just America's war. Since 9/11, al-Qaeda's safe havens have been the source of attacks against London and Amman and Bali. The people and governments of both Afghanistan and Pakistan are in danger. And the stakes are even higher within a nuclear-armed Pakistan because we know that al-Qaeda and other extremists seek nuclear weapons, and we have every reason to believe that they would use them. These facts compel us to act along with our friends and allies. Our overarching goal remains the same: to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and to prevent its capacity to threaten America and our allies in the future. To meet that goal, we will pursue the following objectives within Afghanistan. We must deny al-Qaeda a safe haven. We must reverse the Taliban's momentum and deny it the ability to overthrow the government. And we must strengthen the capacity of Afghanistan's security forces and government so that they can take lead responsibility for Afghanistan's future. We will meet these objectives in three ways. First, we will pursue a military strategy that will break the Taliban's momentum and increase Afghanistan's capacity over the next 18 months. The 30,000 additional troops that I'm announcing tonight will deploy in the first part of 2010. the fastest possible pace so that they can target the insurgency and secure key population centers. They'll increase our ability to train competent Afghan security forces and to partner with them so that more Afghans can get into the fight. And they will help create the conditions for the United States to transfer responsibility to the Afghans. Because this is an international effort, I've asked that our commitment be joined by contributions from our allies. Some have already provided additional troops, and we're confident that there will be further contributions in the days and weeks ahead. Our friends have fought and bled and died alongside us in Afghanistan, and now we must come together to end this war successfully. For what's at stake is not simply a test of NATO's credibility. What's at stake is the security of our allies and the common security of the world. Now, taken together, these additional American and international troops will allow us to accelerate handing over responsibility to Afghan forces and allow us to begin the transfer of our forces out of Afghanistan in July of 2011. Just as we have done in Iraq, we will execute this transition responsibly, taking into account conditions on the ground. We'll continue to advise and assist Afghanistan's security forces to ensure that they can succeed over the long haul. But it will be clear to the Afghan government, and more importantly to the Afghan people, that they will ultimately be responsible for their own country. Second, we will work with our partners, the United Nations, and the Afghan people to pursue a more effective civilian strategy, so that the government can take advantage of improved security. This effort must be based on performance. The days of providing a blank check are over. President Karzai's inauguration speech sent the right message about moving in a new direction. And going forward, we will be clear about what we expect from those who receive our assistance. We'll support Afghan ministries, governors, and local leaders that combat corruption and deliver for the people. We expect those who are ineffective or corrupt to be held accountable. And we will also focus our assistance in areas such as agriculture that can make an immediate impact in the lives of the Afghan people. Now, the people of Afghanistan have endured violence for decades. They've been confronted with occupation by the Soviet Union and then by foreign al-Qaeda fighters who used Afghan land for their own purposes. So tonight, I want the Afghan people to understand. America seeks an end to this era of war and suffering. We have no interest in occupying your country. We will support efforts by the Afghan government to open the door to those Taliban who abandon violence and respect the human rights of their fellow citizens. And we will seek a partnership with Afghanistan grounded in mutual respect, to isolate those who destroy, to strengthen those who build, to hasten the day when our troops will leave and to forge a lasting friendship in which America.
You've just heard the president's justification for sending troops to Afghanistan right here on the Savage Nation.
We will act with the full recognition that our success in Afghanistan is inextricably linked to our partnership with Pakistan. We're in Afghanistan to prevent a cancer from once again spreading through that country. But this same cancer has also taken root in the border region of Pakistan.
Let's take a quick break from the president's speech in Afghanistan right here on the Savage Nation. We'll be right back.
Savage.
Well, as you've heard, President Obama is going to send 30,000 additional troops to Afghanistan, but Obama plans to end the war and withdraw most U.S. service members within 3 years. Well, how can you say within 3 years when you're going to fight a war with one hand behind your back? The good news for those of you who are so gung-ho for this war is that Obama is ordering military officials to get the reinforcements to Afghanistan within 6 months. Wow. Apparently, the fact of the matter is this will be the second escalation of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, an Islamic country, since he came to power in January, so much for him being an anti-war president. Part of this commitment is that Obama will seek further troop commitments from NATO allies as part of a so-called counterinsurgency strategy, where they claim to wipe out al-Qaeda elements and to stabilize the country while training Afghan forces. Good luck. You think that they're going to be able to take these tribes and control them? I don't believe so. I think more men are going to fight and be maimed and die. And at the end of the day, it's another Vietnam. Everyone knows that. We don't know what we're doing there. Now, this new troop deployment will increase the total U.S. commitment to 100,000 troops in Afghanistan, supposedly to be bolstered by 45,000 NATO forces, whatever they're worth. Obama has come under pressure on both sides to withdraw and to escalate. Apparently, he's come to the conclusion that the deployment must be accelerated to knock back the Taliban. Some observers were surprised by the speedy deployment because White House officials who defended Obama's snail's pace of coming to a decision had first said that the Pentagon wouldn't be able to get new troops to Afghanistan that quickly. Well, I guess that was a lie, too. When asked to explain that apparent contradiction, a White House spokesmouth told CNN, "The president is saying this has to happen, so the military will make it happen." That makes sense. So it is a six-month timeline to send new troops, which is a very aggressive timeline, and it's going to challenge the military to the max. The fact of the matter is they have to train them, equip them, and ship them. Who knows if this will really happen? Now, Obama is trying to do it faster than the 12-month timeline initially requested by General Stanley McChrystal. McChrystal wrote in a report in August that, quote, "a failure to gain the initiative and reverse insurgent momentum in the near term," meaning next 12 months, "while Afghan security capacity matures, risks an outcome where defeating the insurgency is no longer possible." So we're in trouble. The real problem here is that the rules of engagement are such that we can't win, in my opinion. If you say that's defeatism, Savage. I disagree with you. Joining us now with his view on Obama's speech is Jeff Kuhner.
Michael, we knew ahead of time. Obama's people were already telling us, many of us in the Washington press corps, what was going to be in the speech, what Obama's new Afghan war strategy is. And to be brutally honest, Michael, I believe that this will be Obama's Vietnam. I believe that we are now sleepwalking into disaster. And what this man has now embarked upon this nation is a complete and utter betrayal of our troops on the ground and of the national security interests of the United States. For what he is doing, and there's no getting around this fact, Michael, is that Obama is now committing us on a path towards eventual defeat in Afghanistan. For this simple reason, he is replicating the exact same mistakes that Lyndon Johnson committed in the 1960s when he escalated recklessly the war in Vietnam. He is coming in not hard, but soft. He is coming in not looking for a way to deliver a conclusive knockout blow, but to come in already looking to leave before we've even sent in the troops. What the Obama people have been obsessed about, Michael, is they are now looking for an exit strategy. There is an exit strategy before we even sent the troops in.
That's crazy. Sorry, crazy.
And we are making the same mistake that we made in Vietnam. There is no strategy for victory. There is no strategy for us to come in and crush the Taliban and al-Qaeda once and for all. And we are not committed to victory because, as Obama himself said many months ago, he doesn't even want to use the term victory. Michael, what this is one of the most cynical, stupid, manipulative political moves I have ever seen in my lifetime as a journalist. What Obama is now doing is he is trying to do the impossible. He is trying to split the baby, and he can't do that. On the one hand, he is pledging to put in over 30,000 troops into Afghanistan so he can claim to the middle America, he can claim to many of your listeners, to many people in the American heartland, "I am listening to General McChrystal. I am now going to give him most of the troops that he needs to win this war in Afghanistan." But then he can turn around to his anti-war left-wing base, which is already defecting They're already now on the verge of pulling the plug on this war. Many of them are already threatening to protest in the streets of Washington. And he'll stand up and say, well, I didn't give McChrystal his full 40,000 that he wanted because I am the civilian commander-in-chief. McChrystal answers to me. I don't answer to him. And here is what I think is the most cowardly, reckless, and irresponsible thing that Obama has done. What history will never forgive him for, and what the American people should not forgive him for, is we are now coming in not with an army that is designed and supported and backed to win this war. We are coming in for crass political public relations motives.
Exactly.
Obama now senses that his support is now eroding, that his presidency is now in free fall. The economy is now mired in a deep recession. His stimulus package has failed. His tax and spend policies have failed. His health care initiative is bogged down in the Senate and in Congress. Everywhere you look, his support is ebbing and weakening. Even around the world, opinion polls now show the bloom is off the rose. In the Muslim world, Obama is now hated even more than Bush. His support in Europe is fragile and eroding every day. He has bowed to the Emperor of Japan, and he is now seen as the president who bows to foreign leaders, who bows to kings and emperors. He has now been exposed as a weak, pathetic president who is in over his head. And so he does not want to be the man who is known to have lost Afghanistan. Just as Johnson, when he inherited the Vietnam War from Kennedy, said, I will not be the man, the president, who lost Vietnam. And so he is sending those troops in. And his plan is very simple. Win a temporary few military victories in the caves and mountains of Afghanistan. Quell the insurgency temporarily. Push back the resurgent Taliban. And then set up Hamid Karzai as the fall guy. Karzai is now apparently too corrupt for us to deal with. All of these same Democrats who under the Bush year said, you can't have democracy in the Middle East. All of a sudden, they have democracy fever. All of a sudden, they're now born-again Democrats. Karzai came to power on a tainted election in August. Karzai is not a reliable partner. We need a real Democrat in Afghanistan. All of a sudden now, they have become born-again Democrats. Now, suddenly, democracy is so important that we cannot properly back Karzai. And what you heard tonight, that the era of giving a blank check to Karzai is over, is now Obama is doing what he has been doing throughout his entire presidency. He is seeking to blame somebody else for the mess that he created. Because he was the one in March who sent in 21,000 of our boys. He is the one, when the body bag started to come back from Afghanistan, he has now been involved in a pathetic, protracted, three-month review process, dithering in the eyes of the world. And now he has given the Taliban and Al-Qaeda what they want. They wanted a deadline. They wanted a time frame. They wanted a timetable. And now Obama has told our enemy, all you have to do is wait another 3, 4, 5 years, and the Yanks are leaving. The Americans are going to leave with their tails between their legs.
This is unbelievable to me.
And Michael, I have been telling this to people everywhere in this country, and I've been warning them in my column day after day, week after week. In the Muslim world, 5 years is for what is for us 15 minutes. They do not think in years or decades, but in centuries. They are still refighting the Crusades. And Osama bin Laden vowed to his supporters after 9/11, we will bring the American empire to its knees. We will bring the American infidel as we brought the Soviet Red Army here in the mountains and caves of Afghanistan, and we will crush him. We will bleed him to death and we will expose him for the paper tiger that he is. And now under Obama, what are we doing? We are now putting our entire credibility and prestige as a superpower on the line. And there in Afghanistan, where 9/11 was not just planned, it was not just implemented, it was where 9/11 was imagined. It was where 9/11 took place. It was where Al-Qaeda, led by Osama bin Laden and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, said, here, we will fly those planes into the Twin Towers and into the Pentagon and into the White House, and we will declare war upon America. There in Afghanistan, we will now send our troops into a death trap with a political leadership that is now sending them in with such strict rules of engagement, they are going in with not one, but both hands tied behind their back. This is a suicide mission. And now we are to expect that this liberal Democrat, this man who apologizes to everybody in the world, this America hater, this man who has spent his entire life spitting and betraying on the U.S. military, this man who spent 20 years in Reverend Jeremiah Wright's church, where Jeremiah Wright proclaimed that 9/11 was our chickens coming home to roost, this president, we are now expected to entrust our soldiers to him? I say no. We had one policy in World War I. We had one policy in World War II. It was victory. The Yanks are coming. The Yanks are coming. This was our battle cry. And we shook the Nazis to their very knees. We brought them, literally, shook them to their very core and their very foundations. To this day, the Germans don't know how badly we hit them in World War II. They're still reeling from how we destroyed their cities and waged war upon the Wehrmacht and the Hitler's armies. And instead, this, the great American superpower, is now going to fight a liberal, politically correct war where we send the likes of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to civilian court trials, where the likes of Arlen Specter are sponsoring bills where terrorists have a right to sue the U.S. government.
I'm sick of this.
You expect us to believe that our soldiers are going to have the backing from Washington that they deserve? That when the going gets tough, these men are not going to be betrayed by these Chicago-style political gangsters who only care about their next approval ratings and what the latest opinion polls say? Michael, I believe we are in a fight to the finish against the forces of radical jihadism. I believe that the future of Western civilization is at stake. I am no anti-war peacenik, but on this issue, I say clearly and unequivocally, no American should die for an exit strategy. They should die for one thing and one thing only, liberty and victory. And there is no plan for victory in this new Afghan war strategy. There is no plan for us to win this war. If that is the case, the only moral thing to do, the only right thing to do, the only American thing to do is bring our troops home. Don't die for Obama's war, because believe me, when he's out of office in less than 3 years, when he's a failed one-term president and the Taliban come back to power, we will need those men and women to go back into Afghanistan and finish the job we should have finished under George Bush.
Thanks for the report, Jeff.
Michael, thanks once again, my friend, for having me on. It is always an honor and a privilege to be on the Savage Nation.
I'll be right back.
Savage.
Today we've been talking about Afghanistan and our plans, or Obama's plans, for that nation. Joining us now is Mackenzie Eaglin, a research fellow for National Security Studies with the Heritage Foundation, with her views on what needs to be done going forward in Afghanistan.
Thanks very much, Michael, for the chance to talk about the way forward in Afghanistan. This is an important topic because it is a vital national interest of the United States and the first priority of government, which is to provide for the common defense of the United States and of the American people. And as we saw on 9/11, the American homeland has been threatened in the past when the United States abandoned its efforts in Afghanistan. And allowing the return of a safe haven for al-Qaeda through the Taliban in Afghanistan or even in Pakistan at this point would be dangerous to the American people. The president is right to stick with a counterinsurgency strategy in Afghanistan as opposed to a narrower counterterrorism strategy alone. That's because counterinsurgency is focused on a couple of different things, primarily protecting the civilian population from insurgents and violent extremists, training additional Afghan security forces, both police and army, and helping maintain security so that the civilian development projects may succeed.
Well, how does Afghanistan and its security needs differ from Iraq?
Afghanistan is nothing like Iraq. It's not a rebuilding effort. It's a building from scratch effort. And our counterinsurgency plan there on the ground is like a three-legged stool. And each leg is comprised of security, development, and governance. Without one of those three moving forward in tandem, the stool would collapse under its own weight. All three have to happen at the same time, but security does come first. It is the prerequisite for everything else in Afghanistan. And the training up of the security forces and ensuring that we're leaving behind a free Afghan that leaves a government in place that can provide for its own people and protect them is how we get out of Afghanistan. Nobody wants the United States to stay in the country forever. The alternative, a failure in the country or a premature withdrawal, risks genocide, not just in Afghanistan, but in the region and spillover countries that are important to the United States, a potential resurgent al-Qaeda, a return to a possible 9/11 threat, a pre-9/11 threat, and a destabilization of the region that is very threatening because of the fact that Pakistan and India both have nuclear weapons, and it is in our national interest that those two countries remain stable. Now, General McChrystal, the war commander right now in Afghanistan, presented a plan earlier this year to the president, and Mr. Obama has chosen to go with what I call the Goldilocks option, which is really the middle road. General McChrystal laid out three scenarios to achieve the strategy that the president laid out earlier this year in March, and which is virtually unchanged now.
Well, remind us what those were.
The 20,000 troop risk scenario would run a high risk of failure per the general. And the middle road, which is about 40,000 troops, is a medium risk option. But the president did have an alternative, which was to send 60 to 80,000 additional reinforcements to Afghanistan. And this was the plan with the maximum chance of success at the lowest risk option for U.S. forces. In fact, as General McChrystal said, the high-end troop levels are the best chance to contain the Taliban-led insurgency and to stabilize Afghanistan. So it is a little worrisome that the president has chose to split the difference and go with less than half of the range of the midpoint of General McChrystal's troop recommendation. This is certainly better than no new troops at all. It's undisputed that based on the strategy the president has laid out, more resources are required on the military front, on the civilian front, on the coalition front, and on the private sector and nonprofit NGO front as well. The president's plan is in earnest, and we hope it will succeed. However, Congress needs to make sure now that all the resources are provided, and the president shouldn't be talking about timetables or exit strategies as opposed to victory, because that's really more important tonight. The U.S. has demonstrated in the past and has a history with countries like Pakistan of abandoning them when we said we'd be there. To do so again at this point or to come across as schizophrenic in our message would be very damaging for the troops that we're going to send over there. It takes about 6 months from the time a president issues a new strategy or a new way forward or even a revised way forward and sends additional troops to the theater for all of those things to be implemented on the ground on a tactical battlefield level. Given that General McChrystal said several months ago that the U.S. has a fleeting 12-month window to achieve its mission in Afghanistan and turn things around to show progress, we're already 3 or 4 months into that window, and it's distressing if the troops will be phased in over a period of time based on conditions. Because at this point, what is needed is an all-in jump into Afghanistan to provide the resources necessary, particularly when the U.S. has additional freed up resources based on our drawdown that has begun in Iraq. The war in Afghanistan is not an optional war. If we're not in it to win, we should pull out now, is the thinking of some policymakers in Washington, but that's really a false choice. The United States does not get out of this cost or consequence free if there were to be a premature withdrawal. And the people who would feel that most are not just in the region again, but of course here in the U.S. The president has spoken of the fact that the U.S. does not want to contribute to nation building in Afghanistan, and that's a fair point. In fact, the U.S. needs to be very measured in its goals on the ground in theater. To expect that a Jeffersonian Western-style democracy will emerge and flourish would be incredibly unrealistic and set us up for failure. But trying to build up a government that can serve and protect its people and enable them to defend themselves so that they can become a viable member of the international community is in our best interest and in the region's best interest and in the world's best interest.
Mackenzie Eaglin, thanks for the report.
Thank you again, Michael, for having me on tonight. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Who was the enemy in Afghanistan? First, let's define terms. We knew who the enemy was when the men were fighting against the Germans. Let's start with the obvious. So when the men were fighting, although they were scared to death like every man who fights in war is, at least they knew what they were fighting for and who the enemy was. Can you say with any certainty that you know who the enemy is in Afghanistan and why we're fighting there? If you can, please help me understand it, because I don't. I don't know who the enemy is.
Savage.